Greetings, this is William Evans. We're shifting gears. Our guest today is a visitor from New Mexico, Arena Pittman. Welcome, Arena.
Thank you, Will.
You're here to help with the feeding of a group of permaculture students in the Valley.
Yeah, that's correct. I'm here with the permaculture design course offered by the Permaculture Institute. I'm a co-founder and a director of the Permaculture Institute in New Mexico, Santa Fe, New Mexico. That's where I'm from right now.
And tell us where you lived before you moved to New Mexico.
Okay. Yeah, I lived in Belarus. Belarus is one of the former republics of the Soviet Union. It's a small country west of Russia. So it's between Russia and Poland, if it helps you to place it. It's a small and very beautiful country.
And what's the countryside like?
Well, it's glacial landscape, really. It's very flat and gentle, rolling hills, very few gentle rolling hills, mostly flat, very forested, very green. I think it's the most beautiful place on earth. The weather is maritime influence, so it's Baltic climate. Though we don't have access to the sea, to Baltic Sea, but we are influenced by it.
And you lived at that time in a city?
Yeah, I was born and raised in Minsk, which is the capital of the country. It's a 2 million people city. Again, capital of Belarus. And I spent my entire life in a little apartment in Minsk.
And tell us what happened 25 years ago.
Well, 25 years ago, just about, was an explosion of the Chernobyl nuclear station. I was a girl of 14 at the time. I guess I'm here today going to share some of my memories of that time. Though I was a teenager and I was really not interested in any information other than my own world. But whatever I can remember, I'll be glad to share.
It took a while before you learned that anything had happened at Chernobyl.
Well, yeah, I remember actually seeing the news on TV. Back then at that time, you know, the TV was state-controlled and there was very little programming on TV. So it's really probably even hard for my listeners to imagine how it all went through the news. But the news was offered several times a day. There was only one channel for the news, and it was state-controlled channel. And I remember, actually, despite being an oblivious teenager, frightened, because it was clearly frightening what they were saying, even though very little information was said. But something along the lines that about 3 or 4 days ago, there was an explosion on one of the nuclear reactors in Chernobyl. And there was a fire, and it was all under control. But even then, I don't remember how and why, but I remember being paralyzed with fear because it was very clear that something horrible had happened. And again, it was 3 or 4 days after the fact. Later, I heard that the only reason the government even spoke about it is because the scientific stations in Europe picked up a very high level of radiation. So the government was forced, government of Belarus, actually in this case of Soviet Union, was forced to step forward and speak up. And we were basically told that everything was fine, but my mother worked at the Academy of Science. She was one of the PhDs there, and her friends were working in the physics. Basically, they were the ones who would say, wait a minute, it's not okay to have a fire in a nuclear reactor. It is very, very serious. But the government was not saying what to do as far as health precautions or conduct for the public. They were really concerned about panic in the in the general population. So the only information we were getting was through my mom, who was through her work colleagues, saying, you know, we need to stay home. We need to start taking showers. It is very, very serious. Showers was the way to wash yourself from the dust. The dust was what was contaminated. There was even a moment at one point when people were told, women were told to cut their hair. The reason was because your hair traps dust, and the longer your hair, the less compelling it is to wash it every day or wash it even 5 times a day. So women were told, cut your hair, shave your head. wear only synthetic clothing, because natural fiber attracts dust and you want synthetic, which actually gets staticky, and so it pushes the dust away. And so that was the information coming through my mother.
And you were how far away from Chernobyl, and in which direction with the wind?
Yeah, I keep forgetting the exact distance. I think about 500 miles, 400 miles, I don't know, somewhere in the tune of 500 miles. And a lot of people know about Chernobyl as the Ukrainian nuclear station. The Chernobyl is 3 kilometers from the border with Belarus. Belarus is my home country. The winds blew northwest, which is, again, the direction of my home country. So I don't know if it's exactly so, but what I heard was that Belarus actually suffered and received the most effects of the disaster. Kyiv was affected. Kyiv is part of Ukrainian capital, and Ukraine itself was affected, but Belarus got the bulk of it because the wind was blowing in that direction. And of course, you know, the wind doesn't know the borders, and really no natural forces know that there is a border there. So everything just went right across the border to Belarus. I heard figures of 47% of farmland was contaminated. Again, word contaminated is kind of loose. Contaminated how much, to what degree? And the figures from what I've heard was contaminated for life, contaminated as to be not used. 47% of your agricultural land for an agricultural country that derives its income from agricultural activities is a big number. I also heard somewhere in the tune of 45% of the forests were contaminated. And again, my country is a rural country. It lives from agriculture and from forestry. So again, somewhere close to half of the forests were contaminated. The city where I was from, 2 million people, the rain from Chernobyl, the clouds from Chernobyl arrived and fell on the city. So whomever, people who were in the streets got contaminated. It is really hard for me to know health effects, because I've heard horror stories, and I also personally feel fine and my parents are fine, so it's hard to say statistically what went on.
What happened to your way of life? How did it change as a result of the events at Chernobyl?
Well, there was a big change as far as foods that we eat, the way we spend our time. You know, my family, not just my family, the whole country, really, the culture is that even when you live in the city, we were very connected to the forests and countryside. By means, most people would, on a weekend or even in the afternoons in the summer, get in trains, commuter trains or cars or whatever means of transportation and go to the countryside. Because either they had little patches of land that they were cultivating or they would go to forests. It was our favorite pastime. And it wasn't even just a pastime. It wasn't just sitting there and observing the birds sing. We were harvesting mushrooms and berries and medicinal herbs and things like this. So there was a lot of wildcrafting. And it wasn't that my family was doing it. It was the whole country. It was part of our culture as a whole, which I know here in the U.S. sounds very maybe outlandish in a way almost, but we were really tied to our forests and countryside in a way of deriving food. Not in a desperate way necessarily, but in a joyful way as well. And after Chernobyl, yeah, all of this came to a screeching halt. There was no more going to the countryside, no more going to the forest. Forests were contaminated. Mushrooms have a tendency to accumulate radiation. So basically, when you harvest a mushroom, you would get sort of a package of radiation. Berries, all of this was all off limits. So we stopped going out. We stopped eating a lot of foods that were previously enjoyed and celebrated, if you wish, such as mushrooms and berries. And yeah, so those were the changes. I remember Christmas trees, you know, there was no more Christmas trees. They come from the forest.
Sure.
And my father got a Geiger Geiger counter, which is this little thing that counts radiation. But the trick with radiation is there's three types of radiation. There's alpha, beta, and gamma, and you can only count one kind. And my memory escapes me. I think it's you can only, with Geiger counter, you only count one kind. But the other two, you can't count. In order to go into, sometimes in almost tissue of things like plants or, say, Christmas tree, could be the Geiger counter might be happy, but the tree itself holds plenty of radiation. It's just not detected by the counter. So I remember there was stations set up, eventually scientific stations throughout the country, where you could bring your food and actually get it checked, but they had to burn the food. And then they would do a spectrum analysis of the food. And it was all very, it seemed very ad hoc. I mean, the stations were here and there, and then what do? You buy your egg in the farmer's market and you take it to the station to burn and learn that maybe it's contaminated. Yeah, it wasn't very helpful, basically. People ultimately felt so overwhelmed by it that they just stopped paying attention because you need to keep functioning.
Were you able to eat the eggs and the milk and the cheese?
I don't remember anything particular about any of this, but there was a heightened awareness of where the food came from. For example, Russia, and I can't remember now if it was eggs or milk, there was one type of crop that Russia, not Belarus, I'm from Belarus, Russia determined that there was a higher contamination in their product, and they actually sold it to Belarus at a very cheap price. So we knew not to buy Russian, whatever it was, I don't remember, eggs, milk, cottage cheese, something. But, you know, it all also came ultimately to information. And you know how information is. It's only very few people ultimately end up knowing the right answers. And
it's hard to get good information, isn't it?
It's hard to get good information, and you don't even know if it's good information or not. And how do you not buy, how do you even know if the egg is from Russia? You know, maybe it's labeled, maybe it's not.
What about the economy? How did the economy change as a result?
Again, you know, I remember a lot of talk that countries stopped trade connections with Belarus, and I'm sure Ukraine, and I'm sure Russia. There was definitely a moment of rollback when nobody wanted to buy things, but because it was former Soviet Union, they just kind of basically traded within themselves. And in a setting when there's maybe some kind of a lack of food, or how to say, there's only so much food to go within the country, people basically ate it all, and it was...
And was the monetary system stable?
Well, the monetary system, as a result of Chernobyl, I don't think there was any big results or effects. But later in 1993, there was a big collapse that probably really came from the collapse of the Soviet Union and the economical system of the entire Union. It's sort of, in a sense, much like the United States. It's a conglomerate of separate little, in that case, little countries. There were 15 republics in the Soviet Union. And I think Chernobyl was one of the big disasters that also basically contributed to it eventually.
And what happened to the economy in 1993?
Well, what happened to the economy was... because of the political instability, and I think ultimately the way things were run, the economy one day just collapsed. Whether or not it was expected or unexpected, I can't really say, but we woke up one day with the banks closed, the doors were closed on all the banks, and the government issued a decree of, I guess it was removing two zeros on all the bills, meaning that $100 bill became $1, right, value-wise. So the money, the actual paper money, remained the same, but the zeros were gone, the two zeros were gone. And it might be really? Even more than two zeros. I don't even remember. I remember there was a situation when my parents had savings. It was 3,000 rubles, which doesn't tell you much, but it was enough to buy a house in the countryside with an orchard, because that was actually where they actually went and looked at the house. and the orchard and the shed and whatever else there was, and it was 3,000 rubles. And then they decided it was too much work, and they didn't buy it. And somewhere within that period of time, the collapse came, and then and that 3,000 rubles became not enough to buy a piece of bread.
Wow.
So
from the potential of buying a house and an orchard to not being able to buy a loaf of bread.
Yeah, and that's what was the really astonishing element of it was my family was so-called, you almost could consider them upper middle class, not in the U.S. terminology, but within the
So, yeah,
country.
Tell people your parents were both of engineering backgrounds?
They were engineers. My mother was a PhD in a very reputable research organization. My father was also working on a lot of military contracts and was also a very reputable specialist. And my grandparents also came from high-ranking positions. So, yeah, so basically we were comfortable, very comfortable, I could say. And but that when that whole collapse came upon us, I remember realizing, and I was a young woman then, maybe I was in my, I don't know, early 20s or barely 20. All of a sudden we had two cars and two apartments and a house in the country, and but you can't eat it. There's suddenly you look around and you realize you have possessions that have very little value when it comes to surviving. Day-to-day life, day-to-day needs. There's no food. And so we went through this quite a long period of complete destabilization of culturally, economically, I guess you could say spiritually, because culturally, suddenly you just didn't know how to relate to each other because everything was wiped out. Mostly, I guess the economic system collapse contributed to that feeling. We had days you wake up, you don't know if there will be bread in the store, you don't know how much it will cost, you don't know if it will be 3,000 rubles that used to buy your house or some other figure. The inflation was measured in the price of bread.
Wow. What were you doing at this time of destabilization?
Well, I was a student at a very prestigious college in Minsk.
And you were studying?
I was studying engineering because my parents believed that no matter what happens in the world, heavy industry will always remain stable. That was their belief. And they insisted that I will become an engineer, so I always will have good earning possibilities. Sadly, heavy industry is the first one that goes, and I guess no one realized it. And I was actually going to college and sort of sitting through the exams, realizing that I'm just wasting my time because the factories were closing. There was no money to buy fuel. There was no money to pay people. People were unpaid for 2-3 years in some regions of the country because there was no money. The money just sort of crashed. And of course, it was mafia and all of that extreme. So we're doing and it was all like a giant vortex, if you wish, where you just don't know where you're standing.
So it was
empty
chaos.
Stores. It was total chaos. Yeah, empty stores again. You just go and there's nothing in the store. And we're actually at that time. My mother started a business, so we weren't really exactly needy money-wise at some point. But I remember there was just no food. I just remember being, for somewhere around a year and a half, kind of constantly hungry. Again, not starving, not an empty refrigerator, but there's just malnutrition. When whatever you're eating is just simply not enough, and you could feel it. You're tired, you're down, your skin gets all bumpy and kind of rough, and you're just malnourished.
And what happened then? Did you drop out of school?
No, I finished. No, I finished school.
And then you graduated with an engineering degree?
Yes.
And what did you do?
Well, I upon insistence of my parents, young woman still, went to work in a factory that was collapsing and sat there in an unheated building in a winter, Belarusian winter, minus 18 degrees outside. We were all sitting in our blankets there, literally because there was no heat. The factory did not have money to pay for heat. There was no work to be done. We just sat there. But
you got a salary?
I got a salary. My salary was 25 rubles at the time. Well, it changed, but I remember it was enough to buy my tickets for the bus to get to work and a few oranges per month. That was enough. So, yeah, a few oranges plus transportation to work.
And then you became interested in agriculture.
Yeah, I started by volunteering, actually, for a project that was people were building houses for Chernobyl resettlement village. There was a lot of people that needed to be resettled, basically. But, of course, there was not enough funds, et cetera. So we were building a village of 19 homes for just 19 lucky people from the worst possible contaminated area. And I guess I just felt that I had nothing to lose, so I decided I might as well volunteer and have a good time and do something good than just sit in the factory. and plus, my factory was very happy to give me unpaid vacation because I couldn't pay anyway, so they were happy to let me go. And I started doing that work, learning about alternative construction methods, straw bale, straw clay. That was the first introduction of those methods to Belarus. Then we started working with wind and solar energy. There was, at the time, no weather information for Belarus because you can collect this data very differently. And if you want to do solar energy or wind energy, you collect that data differently than you collect it to just tell people what to expect tomorrow as far as sunny skies. So we actually got funding, the team that I was working with got funding from Germany to do collection of data to establish exactly how you can run those alternative energy applications in Belarus. And then the next twist of fate was permaculture. And that's where I basically spent the next 20 years, I don't know, less than 20, 15 years of my life now, devoted to permaculture, which is sustainable living system. Kind of hard to describe, but it really engages all of those elements of sustainable food production, sustainable house construction, sustainable energy, sustainable waste removal, sustainable communities, all elements, all aspects, every aspect of our living. How do you make it sustainable? So I kind of emerged in that new path of my life, came to me, or I came to it, I don't know. And been working ever since, doing that work.
And tell us who your husband is.
Well, Scott, my husband, Scott Pittman, my husband of 15 years now, he's co-founder of the Permaculture Institute of basically the United States. We're located in Santa Fe, New Mexico. We have a small demonstration site and the office for the institute, and he teaches worldwide.
So you're traveling a lot of the time?
Yes and no. I have a young son now, so we travel sometimes. Sometimes we don't travel. We have also a little farm, which keeps me from traveling too much because I have milk goats and gardens and things. And lately I realized there's no shame in not wanting to travel. I could just stay home and it's okay. So we live in Pewaukee, yeah, and have a beautiful little setup that keeps us fed and watered and very happy and living slow life, that demechanized life, very, very few mechanical things in our life. Washing dishes by hand and washing clothes by hand and milking goats and very happy.
This is William Evans. I'm speaking with Arena Pittman. We're shifting gears. Thank you, Arena. Is there anything else you'd say to us about your experience and where you're at now?
I guess I would like to leave your listeners with an encouraging word of connecting with your traditions and with your roots and with what grandma and grandpa used to do, maybe in many families, and growing your own food and finding joy in those simple activities, because they're joyful and they're really, for me, bring the meaning to my life. And they also have, hopefully, give us a bigger security, ultimately. though I'm trying to look at those things more as joyful things, not things to avoid doom and loom. And so, yeah, happy gardening.
There is a real joy in being in the earth, isn't there?
There is. I just actually heard that contact with dirt, bare skin with dirt, so no gloves, bare skin, helps you to fight off depression. And I was thinking, well, how interesting. We need scientific research to tell us the obvious. And I mean, it wasn't obvious to me until I heard it, but it made total sense. So my question to myself always is, when I'm in doubt, is how would nature do it? What would be the natural, logical response to things? Yeah, what would you do with depression? What would you do with gardening? What would you do with, I don't know, finding calmer, more serene life? Where would you look? And I think nature already gave us all those answers, so yeah.
Thank you, Arena. You're listening to KDNK. This is William Evans. Thank you for listening.